Gary Hansen, welcome to the show.
I'm very happy to be here.
Now, you grew up in the GTA, is that correct?
I sure did. We didn't call it GTA then.
No. More specifically, Etobicoke.
Grew up in Etobicoke.
Right. And did you go to the TSO when you were a kid?
Not really before I was in high school. I took music lessons when I was in elementary school, and I had to take piano lessons, play the guitar. And when I got to high school, I played the double bass. And it was the first time I had the opportunity to play in an ensemble. It was a band, not an orchestra, at West Humber Collegiate in northern Etobicoke. But I started taking lessons actually down at the Faculty of Music and started going to Toronto Symphony concerts. I started high school in 1966, and so I was here for, you know, some of Seiji and for Carl Anschurl, and then Andrew Davis. I heard a lot of Andrew Davis concerts, all at Massey Hall.
Okay, so this is a real homecoming in very obvious ways for you to be heading up the TSO.
Well, not only that, but I think the reason that I ended up being a bass player is that the first time I ever saw a bass live was in grade 6, and a Toronto Symphony chamber music ensemble came to our school, Humber Heights Public School in Etobicoke, which is now gone. And I'll never forget that there was a woman playing the bass, and I'm sure it was Ruth Budd,
mm-hmm.
because she was the only female bass player back then in the Toronto Symphony. And I was completely entranced. And so in large measure, a good deal of my career in the music business is because I was turned on by a Toronto Symphony educational outreach program in grade 6.
I understand that early on in your working life, you worked for a symphony in London, Ontario.
I did.
And part of your job was driving the artists around.
Yes, that's true.
And you've mentioned that you learned a lot from that. What did you learn?
Well, I learned a lot from that. One of the things I learned is that when you're dealing with an artist, don't be late. the lives of artists are very different in many ways from people who aren't artists, and it's a very important quality in somebody who works with artists that you understand what it takes for an artist to go on stage and really, really deliver a fabulous performance. They're putting their entire being on the line when they do that. And for us who have the privilege of working daily with artists, our ability to provide support and to provide an environment in which they can do their best work is actually what's fulfilling for us. And I learned that at the London Symphony Orchestra. My most famous driving story was with Arthur Fiedler.
Wow, late director of the Boston Pops.
Yes, and he came to conduct the London Symphony very late in his career, and we put him on the top floor in the presidential suite of the downtown Holiday Inn, which is a very large room, and I generally called the artists before I picked them up in the morning. I had a lot of other jobs, not just driving artists. And the receptionist at the hotel rang the phone. The phone rang 3 times. She hung up. She said, oh, there are several phones in that suite. I'll try another phone. And another phone rang, and it rang 3 times. And she came back on the line. I said, stop. He's in his 80s. Let one phone ring for a long, long time. So she let one phone ring. The phone finally was picked up, and a very gruff voice said, you need a goddamn cab to get around this hotel room. Anyway.
That's a great story. So from there, all the way up to executive director of the Cleveland Orchestra, how did you get there?
I worked for 3 different orchestras in Canada, London, Hamilton, and the National Arts Centre. I was recruited in the mid-1980s to the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra as their director of marketing. And from there, in 1988, I was recruited to the Cleveland Orchestra as the director of marketing. And so I worked at the Cleveland Orchestra for 28 years, and I had basically 3 different jobs there. I led the marketing effort, and then I was the associate executive director, and then I became the executive director. But through that entire tenure at Cleveland, my portfolio of responsibilities grew, and it grew to include things like the management of the Cleveland Orchestra's summer home at the Blossom Music Center. It included being responsible for the renovation of Cleveland's fabulous 1931 concert hall, the Severance Hall, electronic media and other things. And so that all kind of grew out of the marketing portfolio. And eventually I was asked to succeed my longtime boss, Tom Morris, and did so in 2004.
Now, you are credited with making the Cleveland Symphony one of the most successful and trouble-free orchestras in North America, and it is also arguably the best orchestra in North America. What was the key to success there?
The key to success at the Cleveland Orchestra is that it is so important and so loved by its community. And because it has a long tradition of striving for excellence and never being satisfied and striving for greater and greater achievement. Underlying all of that, and partially because of the role it plays in the community, Cleveland has been blessed with an extraordinary series of long-term leaders. I think I was the seventh or eighth chief executive of the orchestra, and the orchestra was founded in 1918. At the same time, I think we had only had seven or eight music directors when I was there, and almost the same number, maybe a few more board chairs. And so there are very few people in the leadership roles of the Cleveland Orchestra who have served in their role for less than a decade. And it's that continuity of leadership and the devotion of the community that has allowed the orchestra to continue to not just to survive, but to truly thrive artistically and institutionally in a city that has shrunk in the past several decades.
That's true. I'm wondering now, coming to Toronto, which is a growing city, but where the orchestra plays a very different role, how are the challenges here different from in Cleveland?
Well, first of all, the challenges of running a symphony orchestra anywhere are more the same than they are different. And so I don't think we should look at Toronto as being in any way unique in the panoply of symphony orchestras. Toronto, actually, in contrast to Cleveland, Toronto has had a lot more leaders, not so much music directors, but in terms of board chairpersons, the senior volunteer leader who's responsible for the governance of the institution, and a great deal more chief executives. And I would say that what has prevented the Toronto Symphony from growing as rapidly as the city around it has been the failure to have long-term leadership in all three roles. And so there have been many great leaders of this institution in all three roles, but it has been a relatively rare circumstance where Toronto has had really strong leaders in all three roles for any significant length of time.
I see. So you came in as interim CEO with a limit of 2 years. You declare right. That it's hard and firm. Is that still hard and fast?
Absolutely.
Okay, so you're going to be done pretty soon, within a matter of months.
End
of September. So for you in this role, and given what you've just said about the need for longevity, what have you seen as your most important task taking on this role for this short period of time?
I'm not sure that I can prioritize the different things that I am seeking to enable or to change or to build. And so saying most important is probably going to be colored by whatever I'm thinking about and doing about right now. Probably one of the things that I've perhaps achieved in collaboration with some terrific people on the staff and on the board, including donors and members of the orchestra, is the value of experience in choosing leaders, in choosing people to take on roles, whether they're top leadership roles or supporting roles throughout the organization. That experience does make a difference. And this city and this institution are so attractive to people that we can take our time and we can be very, very rigorous in how we choose the people who have the privilege of serving this institution.
For most, the role of music director seems pretty self-evident. You know, they lead the orchestra through the music and involved in programming and that kind of thing. But what about the CEO of an orchestra? What is your job?
That's a great question, and I'll answer it in a second. First, I want to say that the role of a music director may seem self-evident, but it's not. We see the music director conducting, and we know that the music director has a big role in deciding what the orchestra will perform. But it's so much broader and it's so much deeper than that, that we should give our great respect to the men and women who take on the role of music director and who are successful at it. Things which are almost intangible, the sort of the inner rhythm that an orchestra has collectively, is a result of the music director's leadership and frankly, training over some period of time. the color of the sound, the way an orchestra plays together is the deliberate result of a music director's efforts. As for the CEO, it's kind of undefinable. You know, many people will say, well, the CEO has to raise money, or the CEO has to make sure that all the tickets are sold, or the CEO has to be, you know, right on point with respect to touring and recording and managing, et cetera, et cetera. Fundamentally, the CEO has to be a great partner to the music director and the board chair, has to be attentive to all aspects of the institution, all the ones you would think about in terms of, you know, balancing the budget and raising the money and selling the tickets and all of that. But the CEO also has an artistic role in collaboration with the music director. The artistic care of a symphony orchestra is incredibly important, and a CEO has enormous influence on the artistic health of an orchestra. And I'll give you one example. Most great orchestras in the world, when they come to work on Monday morning, or in some cases Tuesday morning, they rehearse and they perform one program of music, you know, 80 to 100 minutes of music, some of which they performed before, maybe with the conductor who's on the podium, maybe not. But that single program in a single week of work is the standard by which great orchestras function. But a CEO can, in pursuit of other goals other than artistic, can decide that maybe we're going to have two programs next week, or in a very difficult week, have three different programs. It may be necessary, don't get me wrong, to do that. But you shouldn't think you're contributing to the artistic health of the institution. You're actually paying a price artistically for it.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, it's a lot for the musicians to have to prepare for 1 week, I know. I mean, I know some, some of them. Yes,
sure.
I am. And I know that those three program weeks are tough.
So we're moving away from them.
Well, that brings us to another question. The TSO has announced the 2018-2019 season. Mm-hmm. And there are some changes in the programming style. Tell us about some of those.
Well, the single biggest one, though it's not terribly visible to the average reader, is that there are fewer weeks with multiple programs. And what that means is that the orchestra and the conductors will have more opportunity to have more rehearsal and, in fact, have more sequential performances of the same program. And so instead of playing a particular program just twice, they play sometimes two, but often three times or even four times. That's how great performances are made. I was uncharacteristically looking at a blog the other day, and the headline on the blog was that the New Creations Festival is going away. And the New Creations Festival is terrific, and it's one of Peter's great realizations of his overall vision. And it is incredibly difficult for the orchestra to perform this, and they do it at a very, very high level, and they do it with the music director on the podium. And so the fact that the music director is there believing in this, leading this, and making it happen is very important. The downside, if there is a downside under the current structure, is that the performances, they're relatively short, which is good because they have relatively little rehearsal. And also, there's only one performance of each piece.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually play that repertoire in the context of a full week's program with a variety of music, perhaps from more than one century, then each of those pieces, especially the new pieces, will get more than one performance. They'll get two or three or four performances. And in fact, instead of having 2,000 people hear the piece, 6,000 people, 8,000 people
right.
will hear the piece. And so we're taking the contemporary music out of this two-week festival format and spreading contemporary music throughout the season. And I think it's actually, it'll be a good thing artistically, it'll be a great thing for the audience to hear, and it'll make possible more rehearsal for the musicians and the conductors.
I'm sure they'll be really happy about that. Just one last question. So far, what has been one of your favorite moments as CEO of the TSO in the last couple of years?
It's, you know, whatever I was doing this morning. I'm very gratified to have the opportunity to serve the orchestra I grew up with. And I got to tell you that the moment that was the most meaningful and emotional for me in my tenure was the first day. The first day was the opening night of the 2016-17 season. And the moment in that concert that was most gripping was when the audience stood up and sang O Canada. Because I spent most of my career in the United States of America. I grew up in Toronto. I grew up with this orchestra. And I stood there and I said, oh my God, I've got Walter Hamburger's old job. And the audience sang wonderfully, and the orchestra played wonderfully. And there have been all kinds of wonderful, wonderful moments since then, but that's the one that sticks with me most viscerally.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for coming home, and thank you for joining us tonight.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.